Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to the special edition of the Feuersteins Fire American Soccer Show as we discuss the latest news on the NASL lawsuit that they just recently lost the decision on towards U.S. soccer, even though there is an update about a possible maybe a miscommunication, a response by the acting judge that declared this lawsuit to go against the NASL, but we'll get to that in a moment. Joining me right now from World Soccer Talk, of course, Kartik Krishnayer. Joining me from Sock Takes over in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Nipun Chopra. We will have Neil Morris on in a few moments as we talk about this discussion about, and there is Neil Morris coming on, joining us right now. Gentlemen, I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of situations to talk about to see if the NASL could find a way to keep their second division sanctioning. And just recently, of course, this past Friday, Saturday, the judge that acted on the case said no. But apparently there's been a turn, but we'll get to that turn in a moment. Neil Morris first, of course, is Neil Morris is with WRALSportsFan.com, but he's also a mediation lawyer. So it's always good to have Neil on to discuss mediation discussions. Neil, after what happened originally with that decision by this judge in the Second Circuit in Brooklyn, New York, did you think it was a fair result of what she had to say, or did you think there were some improprieties in this?
Well, improprieties is a strong word.
I apologize if it's strong. I didn't mean.
No, I don't want to get it. I don't want to get into ethical issues here. The analysis by the judge seemed to be reasonable on its face. Now, again, people on either side of any legal dispute can reasonably disagree about the trier, the fact, and the interpretation of law. So there's nothing hard and fast about any of this. I think the judge's analysis, given sort of the vagaries of such things as heightened standards of review and burdens of proof, that's kind of where a lot of these cases end up falling. I think the decision was proper under the analysis that the judge adopted, or at least felt like was applicable to the situation. And rather than a whole long review of the decision itself, I think that the order denying the preliminary injunction turned on two things from a legal point of view. One, which a lot of folks didn't appreciate until the judge brought it up herself, and it may be something that's more endemic to the Second Circuit, is that there was a heightened burden of proof, or heightened elements that the NASL had to meet, because the judge chose to treat this as what is called a mandatory injunction, as opposed to a run-of-the-mill preliminary injunction. They're both preliminary injunctions, but one's called a mandatory injunction. And the difference is that a mandatory injunction is asking a party or a side to undo a decision that's already been made, whereas a run-of-the-mill preliminary injunction is where you're trying to keep something from happening. Now, why is that important? Well, it's kind of, I think it's analogous to cases where someone's been granted a benefit or something and now someone's trying to take it away. And the courts have said that should require a higher standard than just trying to stop a process before it happens. What I really think it's all about, what I really think is the psychology behind the difference is, courts don't like folks to use it as a second bite at the apple, meaning, in this case or in any other case like it, If there's a process that you object to, yet you avail yourself for that process, and now you're going to court simply because you don't like the decision or they don't like the outcome, courts look a bit askance at that. In other words, if you had objections to the process and the standards and all of the procedures, then the court's basically saying maybe you should have come to us, you know, first, only because you lost, didn't get the outcome you wanted. Now you want us to jump in. So that's the higher standard. And the higher standard here, although there's a lot of sort of shades of gray here, it's that instead of just having to show a likelihood of success on the merits, the NASL had to demonstrate a clear showing that they would be entitled to relief. There's a lot of permutations there, but that's as best as I can distill it. And under that higher standard, the judge felt that the NASL had not made a clear showing. A lot of smoke, a lot of plausible claims for a possibility of conflicts of interest between U.S. Soccer and MLS. A lot of showing regarding the fact that the original purpose of some of these professional league standards that determining divisional sanctioning may not have been pure when they were first implemented at the outset of MLS. A lot of smoke. But in order to make a clear showing, or even to win at trial, frankly, you're going to have to show tangible conflicts and impropriety on behalf of the defendants in the decision-making process when it comes to the sanctioning. So that's what was not demonstrated, or at least to a clear showing, and that's why the judge ended up saying that the NASL had not met its burden of proof for the purpose of a preliminary injunction. That's not throwing out the lawsuit. Let me be clear about this. The case in chief presumably can continue absent any other procedural or motions that could be filed and ruled upon. The appeal right now is an interlocutory appeal or appeal during the process of the judge's denial of the preliminary injunction, which the NASL was just trying to keep their Division II sanctioning while this litigation was pending. The judge said no, they're appealing that, and that's where we are now.
Okay. Before I move on to our next guest, we usually don't take callers. I'm gonna take one here, and let's see what happens here. Area code 305, yes, sir, or miss, who are you, and what question do you have for the panel?
Yeah, I'm Roger. Basically, I want to touch on a couple of points. I would like to know what you guys think about it. The first one, and I'll try to be very brief. Carty was Chris Nyer, which probably we both follow on Twitter, was mentioning that the NASL was divided at the beginning whether to take this case to a U.S. court or CAS. Now, wouldn't it have been a better choice to take it to CAS, considering that the U.S. sports status quo has been almost invincible in U.S. court? It's like they never lose. And taking the case to CAS, would that be added pressure on FIFA, because there will be multiple CAS cases against the USSF? That is consideration number one. The second one, the NASL. Mm-hmm. As a fan, I'm very confused about them, because Rocco have shown some leadership and have been very bold, denouncing the corruption that is on the U.S. But at the same time, the NASL is also a closed league. They don't charge $100-$150 million, but they charge like $5 million. So what makes them any difference? If you're denouncing the system, be the alternative.
Okay, Roger, I'm going to let Kartik answer, and thank you very much, sir.
Sure.
Go ahead, Kartik.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Roger. And that's exactly right. The first point Roger made was about my reporting a while back that there had been some owners within the NASL family. And it's, I think we flush out things further in this show. You'll see that the NASL as an entity is dysfunctional. There's not a common purpose or a common goal among all the ownership groups, which is something we have kept coming back to for 7 years. And I know Neil in particular has articulated himself really forcefully and vocally and correctly on this topic through the years. I tend to believe it would have probably been a better idea to go through the court for arbitration on sport. That is the procedure you typically follow if you have a case for relief against a professional soccer league that is part of a member association of FIFA. You go to the CAS, you file a claim, and you move forward that way. The reason I don't believe it was done was because the NASL is in such a perilous state. A CAS claim will take years to sort out, and they wanted this temporary injunction or mandatory injunction, as it turned out to be. They wanted an injunction quickly to get some quick relief and then figure it out from there. So I think the U.S. courts were probably used because the U.S. court system was used because of the need for an injunction and an injunction quickly. So that's probably the reason it was filed in U.S. court rather than the CAS. The second point, yeah, the NASL is a closed league. I pointed this out time and again, Roger, as you might know, that there are elements of the NASL LLC agreement and of the way the league is structured and functions, which are more like leagues abroad than MLS or USL, or USL especially. USL has a structure that is completely alien to this sport, or quite frankly, to probably most even closed professional leagues in the United States. Maybe we'll get into that later tonight. But the NASL is also a closed league. There's no two ways about it. And as I think Nipun knows, and maybe we'll get his take on this, there is an aversion, and Nipun and I have talked about it in the past, there is an aversion among some NASL owners, not all of them. We know Ricardo Silva has filed a claim with the CAS on promotion and relegation. There is an aversion with some NASL owners, as I reported in 2015, and I think Nipun's reported more recently, to opening the system up and having a straight open league with ProRel and the possibility of their clubs being relegated to NPSL or some other league.
And Nipun, if you know that, once again, that's, you know, we got two different discussions going on one show here, obviously. And of course, we'll get to that discussion maybe down the road somewhere else. But still, though, I think that's the one thing that's, you know, we're having an issue here is, like, you're seeing one side of NASL owners or an owner of the NASL, as in Mr. Ricardo Silva, trying to bring promotion relegation into our leagues. Of course, you're having the Rocco Commissio and the NASL as a whole trying to remain second division status. And I think that's the big question down the road is, you know, which one is the greater good at the moment? And I think at the moment, nothing against ProRel. I mean, you know, we've made our feelings clear about it, but still, you know, for the NASL to remain second division of some sort, you know, this is what they're trying to do. They feel they want to remain afloat in second division before even tinkering with third division or basically bust.
Yeah, I mean, are you asking me if it's important for NASL to remain Division Two?
I think for now, you know, that should be the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for them, but I think a better question is, why is it important for them? Is it really important for them in terms of generating revenue from sponsorships? Is it really important for them for media partnerships? I would argue maybe. In other words, I'll straddle the fence on that. I think a larger conversation is about egos here. You know, a lot of these owners are very successful businessmen, and they don't want to be they don't want to be associated with the failure. Losing Division II status is a failure in the eyes of, I'm sure it's a failure in the eyes of Mr. Rocco Commissio and Ricardo Silva and Robert Palma, etc. I don't think that being Division III would hurt their bottom line much worse than it does now. Let's remember what I reported last week. Delta's lost $8 million this year. I'm aware that there's some teams. It's open news now that there's a team that lost more than $10 million. So are we really going to argue that these teams losing going down to D3 would mean they're going to lose $20 million? I don't really think so. I think they would lose less money because they'd be more prudent with their transfers and their salaries. So I think the bigger question is, why is it important for these teams to be D2? And I would wager that it's less a business issue and more a personal pride issue, at least the way I look at it.
I would agree with you there as well. I think it's more about ego than obviously worrying about how you're going to make your business model going forward and being, a positive one. But still, Neil, as I like to try and bring back, of course, what this conversation is about with the ruling from Judge Margot Brody in Brooklyn, she felt that although the court finds that plaintiff has shown irreparable harm, that the balance of hardships tips in its favor, and that an injunction would not harm the public interest because, as set forth below, the court finds that plaintiff has not made a clear showing of entitlement to relief. The court denies plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction. And now all of a sudden, Neil, if we can get to, of course, what the recent news has been, that the NASL feels that the interpretation is not what they were looking for. And do you think that's a second bite or third bite of the cherry, in your opinion? Neil?
Sorry.
Did we lose Neil Morris?
No, the appeal of a court decision that doesn't go your way is the most unsurprising thing in the area of jurisprudence. The fact that a party avails themselves of an appeal right is not just expected, but for them not to do it would be derelict, considering the fact that you filed a lawsuit to start with. So there's nothing wrong with them doing that. As a matter of fact, that's what they should do. Mm-hmm. If they believe in their case. As far as their likelihood on appeal, again, all the research that I've looked into and all the legal experts I've consulted and my own experience is that it's going to be reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, which is a very high hurdle that's very difficult to overcome. And as well it should. You don't want, as you would say, you couch it as sort of a second or third bite at the apple. It's not quite that. That would be a completely mm-hmm. new hearing with a clean slate. This is where an appellate panel is going to look at the judge's decision and say, did she abuse her discretion? Was there some legal analysis that was lacking? Was there a misapplication of the legal standard? And I did a Twitter thread last week and sort of wrote up an article that might be out tomorrow the only, and this was in the Twitter thread I did last week, And the only reason I feel somewhat vindicated is that it was a focus for about a day, for about a page or so, by Jeffrey Kessler and their appeal. I don't want to get too wonky about this, but the legal standard for meeting the elements of a mandatory injunction was an either or standard, clear showing or what's called extreme harm. And that's the way it read, and the judge cited that, and then in a footnote kind of dispensed with the second prong of that and said, it's unclear whether extreme harm means irreparable harm, but it doesn't matter because I'm going on clear showing standard, which was a little odd because when you have a standard that's either or, and the NASL is alleging that they met one part of that, and then the judge kind of just dispenses with that and says, well, I'm just going to go with the first part. That struck me as a little odd, and I didn't know if it was just me, but then when I read that the NASL's reply, they spent a lot of time talking about that may not be enough. And other than that, I don't see anything out of the ordinary, at least at this stage of the litigation. Going back to the topic that you guys were just discussing about the need to remain D2, because for a long time I was befuddled by the fact that the league just wouldn't go to D3 and reconstitute. It almost seemed like they were going out of their way to take the least restrictive path to survival. I don't dispute the fact that the origin of some of these folks getting into the league, some of these owners getting into the league, was a desire for D2, and that it becomes a vanity thing or maybe a pride thing. The only thing I'll add, and I've repeated it ad nauseum on social media and elsewhere, is that I think that there is a monetary and practical element to this, which is why you're kind of seeing a rush to try to preserve D2 as opposed to any other moving to D3 or trying to argue that there shouldn't be divisional standards, I mean, divisional tiers to start with. You know, we know that from prior lawsuits that the NHL has filed, at least at one point, and I presume that this is still the case, that their LLC membership agreement contains a clause that if the league ever loses D2 status, the fee for withdrawing from the league plummets. Back in 2013, it was from $2 million to $25,000. If that construct is still the same, and if those numbers are still anywhere in the same vicinity, that's a huge deal, because not only does it eliminate any ability for the remaining members to recoup money from members that leave, it essentially opens the door to people to get out from under what has become an increasingly thorny and expensive membership in a company. I think it would be safe to say that a lot of these members have not left the LLC, the NASL, over the last couple of years simply because it would be very expensive to do so. And if the league loses their Division II status, it potentially opens the floodgates for these folks to make the very prudent business decision to say, you know, I got to take advantage of this and get out from under it. So, that, you know, in my personal opinion, when the NASL says keeping D2 is our means of survival, my personal opinion is that's what they're talking about, because they know what will happen based on the terms of their membership agreement if they lose that status.
Yeah, I mean, I can see where they're coming from and how it's all worked out. Now, Kardik, I want to throw this at you, of course. What was said here in, I think, the crux of the discussion, as Neil's probably said, but I want your opinion about it. And first things first, I want to give credit to Mr. Mickey Turner, who is a lawyer as well, who has been, you know, posting stuff on Twitter about what's been going on. I just want to give him credit for finding some of this stuff online as well and talking about it through Twitter as well. I want to congratulate him. As Kardik, this is what was, I think, the most important thing here is an expeditious reversal decision below is more than warranted. The district court made two fundamental legal errors. First, the court applied the wrong legal standard in assessing the NASL's motion, requiring the NASL to meet a far higher burden in assessing likelihood of success on the merits that is required under controlling Second Circuit precedent. And second, in analyzing the NASL's likelihood of success, the court misinterpreted basic requirements of a Sherman Act one claim. The court below found in favor of the NASL on all other preliminary injunction factors, irreparable harm, balance of hardships, and the public interest. The issues on appeal will thus turn on the applicable standard and likelihood of success. I know you also, Kardik, saw that as well, and you posted it on Twitter. Is this can we say keeping the boat afloat for the NASL, because there has been maybe a misrepresentation from Judge Brody?
Well, yeah. I mean, attorneys like Jeffrey Kessler get paid a lot of money to find fault with these sorts of orders from a judge, from Judge Brody. And it was a very closely balanced order, if you read the entire thing, which I think the three of us have. I've read it twice, actually, that the balance was tipped in favor of the Federation, but only just. And I think the appeal, based on what you've just outlined, is on the premise that there is substantial findings already from the lower court that shows irreparable harm, shows damage to the NASL, and shows, as Neil described it, smoke, maybe not a fire, but smoke in terms of a potential collusion between Major League Soccer and the United States Soccer Federation, which in turn creates an unfair playing field and antitrust issues in relation to the United States Soccer Federation. And keep in mind, the USSF does not have an antitrust exemption under the Sherman Act from Congress. Now, if Sunil Gulati and Dan Flynn want maybe their congressman or their senator to file that and go through the process, the legislative process of giving the United States Soccer Federation an antitrust exemption, similar to what Major League Baseball has, then they can go through that process. But until that happens, and by the way, that's not going to happen, and it's never going to happen. Until that happens, they're subject to this sort of judicial review, and I think it's very a very healthy thing for the member leagues and for the federation to have to go through this sort of review from the court system.
Yeah, that's very interesting as well. Nipun, let me throw this one at you, of course. This was the official statement from U.S. Soccer back on November the 4th. U.S. Soccer's responsibility is to ensure, the long-term stability and sustainability of all professional leagues operating in the United States, as well as the teams that compete within those leagues. After providing numerous opportunities over the years for the NASL to meet the professional league standards or at least provide a pathway to meet those standards, the elected and independent members of the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors ultimately made a decision not to sanction the NASL as Division II league. The decision was made in the best interest of soccer in the United States, and today's decision confirms it was the correct decision. U.S. Soccer is committed to finding ways to improve the long-term viability of all leagues and teams, and by doing so, continue building upon the growth of soccer in the United States. U.S. Soccer is committed to working with NASL as it considers its future. Nipun, in your personal opinion, do you think U.S. Soccer has done so, or do you think – and I'm not trying to say they're favoring MLS or USL over NASL or favoring USL over NASL or whatever, but still, though, the truth of the matter is, do you feel that U.S. Soccer has done enough where they had to make this move going forward with the situation and the way that the NASL is structured currently?
Thanks for asking me a super loaded question, Daniel.
You're welcome.
There is definitely validity to the U.S. what U.S. Soccer has said therein, and validity to stripping NASL off its D2 sanction. In the fact that NASL has been warned over and over and over again, it is an antagonistic league against U.S. Soccer. There is a lot more to this. There's a lot of truth to what U.S. Soccer has said, but can we really say with any by what metric can we argue that this is good for the sport as a whole? Losing teams, losing a league, surely isn't good for the sport as a whole. U.S. Soccer talks about this improving the status of the sport. Obviously, the biggest counterpoint is what happened on October 10th of this year. So there's a lot more to this. There's a lot more undercurrent to what they're saying in this press release that I feel should be discussed. But from my perspective, if I am looking at it objectively, I absolutely think U.S. Soccer did have good reason to strip NASL off of D2 sanctioning to begin with. Are there other reasons? Are there other issues with USSF? 100%. But objectively, what they did with NASL in terms of the 2017 stripping of the 2018 season D2 sanctioning, was that appropriate? Was that fair? I think so, yes.
Well, you know, obviously these are tough times, gentlemen. Of course, with what's happened with our national team, of course, being eliminated from not just qualifying for the World Cup, but being eliminated from that playoff position in the fourth of the hex after that result down in Trinidad Tobago did not go their way. And at the same time, they did not perform at the level that we are normally seeing our national team perform at. And of course, everything's falling right on the lap of Sunil Gulati. And it's just one of those things, gentlemen, that, you know, I think it's very interesting and telling why U.S. Soccer is being, which they should always be held to a higher standard, no matter if it's involving the national teams, the youth national teams, as well as the governance of the game in the professional club level. And Neil, do you feel right now that while even though U.S. Soccer says that they are feeling a little bit vindicated, do you think it's not enough the way things have gone so far within the last couple of months?
Oh, my goodness. Nipun thought he got a loaded question.
I ask a challenging question. Gentlemen, come on.
Well, this is probably something that Kartik feels far more strongly about. I'll confine this to the NESL discussion, just because if I try to tackle it from a wide-ranging point of view, we could go down any number of rabbit holes. As far as its supervision of lower division soccer, I think there's a consensus that they have not done as much as they can. Although I wonder whether their sins are those of omission or commission. It's a wild, wild west. It's a hard animal to tame. Kartik was in the middle of the establishment of D2 standards back in 2010, which was an effort to sort of rein in just the revolving door of lower division soccer. And frankly, in some ways, it worked for a while. And there's a lot of folks who sort of bemoan the fact that we have teams trying to eat teams and monopolize or cannibalize or whatever different markets. And while it's very ugly, I have also been of the contrarian opinion that in our capitalistic system, competition is sometimes good. And the reason I say that is because I saw second and third division soccer pre-NASL. And it was just a wasteland, at least in my opinion. It was just dead. And while there's certainly been tumult over the last several years, to say the least, I think Division II soccer as a whole is better now than it was in 2008, 2009. Now, it may have been with different actors. The NESL was doing quite well from 2011 to 2013. USL made some changes, and now they have a very robust league. So from that point of view, the competition has been good, and that's the way I view it. Now, a capitalistic system also breeds have-nots, and it also breeds lawsuits. So I mean, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the good and the bad of the system that we have. And U.S. soccer has a really weird place in this, and this is where the NASL situation, is illustrative. Let me give you one example. I mean, in the NASL, I'm sorry, U.S. Soccer in our system has to essentially act as a member association of FIFA. They have to carry out FIFA's edicts and statutes. But they also, as we've been reminded many, many times in many, many different subjects, they have to abide by U.S. law. And this case is an illustration of that. We have divisional tiers because FIFA essentially kind of sort of says so, but why do we? We don't have promotion and relegation. What's the point? And I know this was an argument the NASL was making two or three years ago and somehow sort of abandoned it for the purpose of this preliminary injunction, which I thought was curious. But why do we have that? It would seem to be almost more of a straight-line approach for the U.S. soccer to say we're going to adopt baseline league standards. Hopefully that passes antitrust muster. It probably would. And that all leagues just are what they are. Then we're not in this divisional tier nonsense. And I've sort of my personal journey, I've kind of come to this conclusion. And the other thing that U.S. soccer, sort of the line that they have to toe, we've seen it in this case. Yeah, they've got their obligations under FIFA, but at the same time, this case, if it's done nothing else so far, and we're sort of in the infancy of the case from a procedural point of view, if it's done nothing, it's reinforced what some people maybe didn't know or didn't realize or still chose not to believe, which is U.S. soccer's regulation of pro soccer in this country is subject to U.S. antitrust law, which is something that was not a given before this case. And maybe in some other setting it might not be a given again, but U.S. soccer hasn't made that argument in this case, as they have done many times over the years. So That's my very long way of saying that, yeah, U.S. soccer, quote, needs to do better, but, man, they've got a lot of obstacles to avoid. Each of our leagues are essentially separate businesses operating under U.S. law, and U.S. soccer has to also follow FIFA. It's a mess. And I'm not, you know, some of it, again, may be acts of commission by U.S. soccer, but some of it is just the process and our nature of business and the nature of all that this is. And I don't know if there's an easy out when it comes to any of this, when we're talking about the subject that we're discussing tonight. You know, again, mm-hmm. I pontificated that maybe we should do away with divisional tiers. But we can bang away at U.S. soccer, and I'm sure Cardick would love to. But man, it's a hard slog to navigate all these treacherous waters.
Very true. But I want to go to Cardick for a different way here, because I think, you know, Cardick and I, we had a bit of a discussion through Twitter, of course, privately. And I wanted to throw this out there, Cardick. As of right now, from Cranes, New York. Apparently, New York State Senator Chuck Schumer has put his, shall we say, political hat in this ring because, you know, he is there as a friend, I guess, or as a member of the board of Mediacom that I just recently found out of asking U.S. Soccer to keep the NASL as a second division league. Now, Cardick, you know, we always talk about how FIFA does not like governmental interference in, you know, in the game of soccer, football. I mean, we know what the whole situation in Guatemala went through when Guatemalans were being suspended by FIFA, who was running the Guatemalan FA. And then, of course, the Guatemalan national, the governmental sport chief, said, no, you know, you're going to not be suspended by Guatemala FA because, you know, FIFA has no right to suspend you. And then, you know, all these, you know, Harry Carey situations popped out of the blue and Guatemala got basically thrown out of the CONCACAF Champions League because of the government's interference with their sport minister. You know, what Schumer is doing, maybe not doing yet, but could be, do you think this is interference? And then, of course, as we talked about, you know, what will President Donald Trump do, you know, let's just say for the heck of it, he throws his hat in the ring to, I guess, you know, with Eric Winalda. But that's a different story. We'll get to that differently. But do you feel Schumer's involvement now, maybe it's a little bit, but do you think this involvement may also call FIFA to investigate?
Well, I think at this point, it's an internal letter, but it's a letter from a U.S. senator that, at least ostensibly, a U.S. senator, the Senate minority leader, that represents a state which potentially could lose a professional soccer team, a letter to the U.S. Soccer Federation. We've seen Ohio Governor John Kasich weigh in on the Columbus Crew situation. So it doesn't rise to that level yet. But let me caution here, because the last thing we need is a lot of politicians attacking, you know, getting involved in the sport in this country, interfering, causing problems for the U.S. Soccer Federation with FIFA, and then maybe even attacking the judiciary because of this ruling from Judge Brody. I'm very suspicious when politicians get involved, and the link between Schumer and Camiso, based on being on the board of Camiso's cable company, is troubling. And you mentioned Donald Trump. I don't necessarily want to talk about that, but there have been rumors floating around about that as well, that the president might even have an interest in this. We've seen in Chile, we've seen in Guatemala, as you mentioned, we've seen in Hungary, we saw in Romania, in Bulgaria. What happens if even the court system and in those countries, independent judiciaries get involved in the business of the governance of football in those countries. So we're already on a very, very tight line here, very thin ground. I want to believe that Senator Schumer's letter is about the loss, potential loss of jobs in New York State, and not about the other link. And if it is a politician who represents a constituency which is losing a football club potentially because of this, that's one thing. But if it's a politician with ties to an owner getting involved and then making demands, saying, well, the job that you have to keep them as Division II, they can't be Division III, or they have to be Division I, they can't be Division II, then we have a problem. We have a problem with FIFA, and this goes back to what Neil was just talking about. I'm not terribly sympathetic with the U.S. Soccer Federation in general, but in this case, I would be, because I think they've very clearly written pro league standards that they feel like they have some authority to enforce. That authority to enforce it has now been affirmed by a court, at least for now, and you'll have politicians messing around the edges and creating conflicts between U.S. law and FIFA and trying to make your way through the minefield of FIFA and FIFA governance statutes, in addition to not only U.S. code and U.S. law and antitrust law, as Neil mentions, but then also politicians. Finding an issue to demagogue about. So I think it's a very, very tough place to be in. And I hope Schumer's letter is about the loss of jobs in New York State, and that's the reason it was done. And I fully endorse it if that's the case. But we can't have potential conflicts of interest and connections between politicians and owners of professional soccer teams becoming a cause for politicians to interfere in the governance of the game in this country. Because if that happens, we are in big trouble, and it's a slippery slope, and we're all going to end up crashing at the bottom of that slippery slope.
Nipun, I want to go to you on obviously the personal level, because you do cover the Indy 11 for Sock Takes. And if I can just ask this question, obviously the owner, Ursel Özdemir, your president, Jeff Belskis, what's their opinion about this whole situation with what's going on between the Federation and the league? Because obviously, to me, I would like to think that, you know, this is not something that, you know, they're taking lightly. And are there concerns about, you know, where they're going to go if this whole NESL situation either does get their second division sanctioning, or they will give up D2 for D3, or do you think, you know, everyone, or do you feel maybe the league will dissolve? What are you hearing from your owner of Indy 11, or from the owner of Indy 11, excuse me?
Yeah, Indy 11 is now definitely the will they, won't they. It's the story of North Carolina FC last season, where there were rumors that they would be leaving the NHL last season. This season is pretty clear that they will be exiting the league. And now Indy 11 is the will they leave, will they stay question. I've not had an opportunity to talk to either Mr. Özdemir or Mr. Belskis, but what I'm hearing is that, and I was going to write an article on this, but what the hell, we should just talk about it. Indy 11 was offered the opportunity to leave the NASL, based on what I'm hearing, in both August and September. There were contracts that were available to Indy 11 to exit the league. I'm told, this is the part I haven't been able to confirm, so I would say this is highly conjectural, this next sentence. I'm told that there was a much reduced exit fee. Yet again, have not been able to confirm that, but I'm confident in saying that Indy 11 had the option to leave the league, had advanced discussions with USL in August, September. At the end of the day, decided not to sign the contract to exit the league in both August and September. Now, I don't know what happens. I think Indy 11 is in a slightly privileged position in the sense that USL does want this market. But I'm not sure how long that patience will last, because at some point USL is probably going to withdraw. Well, maybe they won't, but just logically, it seems at some point they would withdraw the option for Indy 11 to join the league as time rolls on and they have to prepare for their next season. So is this a shot in the foot from Mr. Ozdemir based on now that NASL might not be a D2 league or likely will not be a D2 league is how we should phrase it now. Is this a shot in his foot? Possibly. Is he going to be happy with D3 if it means that he gets to be, quote, unquote, independent, whatever that means? Unclear at this point. Because my girlfriend's work is one of the sponsors for Indy 11 this year. And because of that, I was able to be in the owner's box for the last home Indy 11 game. What I can say is that Mr. Ozdemir was freely discussing all things about the future. And even though I didn't specifically ask him this question, he seemed to suggest that all options are on the table. But who knows? I guess to summarize my long-winded response to your pretty pointed question, I have no idea. And I don't think anyone except Ursula Ozdemir has any idea. I don't even think Mr. Belskis would be able to answer your question. This is completely an Ursula Ozdemir decision, and we'll see what happens. I will add this.
Yeah.
The Indy 11 faithful, the Brickyard Battalion, have been pretty vocal in their desire to leave for the USL. There was a USL banner. There's a USL please, I think it says, banner. They were chanting the Brickyard Battalion to exit the league. I think the tide has turned. At this point last year, I think I would have given I would say Brickyard was probably 40-60 in terms of 40 to exit, 60 to leave the league, to stay in the league. I think it's probably 90-10 right now of fans who want to join USL and leave NASL.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what's going to happen there. Neil, I'm going to have two questions for you, obviously. And one is from a question from Twitter by someone that is listening to this program right now. What about FIFA's traditional position against soccer issues taken to regular court systems? Do you feel this is a violation of what FIFA standards are with this situation being taken to a regular court within the U.S. Government through the mediation process of what you are normally familiar with, or do you think this is a nothing question?
Both. is it a violation of the edict that you're supposed to submit matters to the Court of Arbitration for Sport as opposed to ordinary courts of law? Yes, it is. But we have seen that happen both domestically and internationally at various times over the years. I mean, the Kardec loves to bring up, and he's correct, you know, the example of when USL filed a lawsuit against NESL back when the original split took place in 2009-2010. I mean, all of those were presumably violating the spirit of that rule. I think that's just my personal opinion is FIFA is not going to take punitive action based on that, because I think that is, it's there more to keep folks in line and not just run to the courts for every little thing, as opposed to a hard and fast rule that they swiftly act upon every time it's violated. So that's my first answer.
Okay. Nope, that's fine. Now we're going to – I want to go, of course, to something about North Carolina FC. Now, let me just say that Neil Morris has done a very good job of telling anyone and everyone wondering why Steve Malik was not involved in this sort of situation, because, as you know, with North Carolina FC, I think you probably have – like what Napoon has said, they're probably already ready to go to USL for next year. My question to you is this. Why would people assume Steve Malik would be on the NASL Board of Governors if he is? And if not, you know, why do they think because Rocco takes the whole thing himself here, or just Malik didn't want it to be a part of this Board of Governors situation within the NASL, because it sounds like he is on his – or is on his way going to USL?
That's a – yeah, there's a lot of
loaded question
to that answer. Well, it's a lot.
Is it loaded? I'm trying not to make it.
No, it's not loaded. Let me try to unpack that a little bit.
Sure thing.
As far as what Malik's position was within the league, he was not ever chairman of the NASL Board of Governors. The reason I know that is because I asked him at varying intervals all year because I assumed he eventually would be, and he never was. And that's a question I was asking him beginning when they got Division II, provisional D2 sanctioning in January, and Malik was sort of the spokesperson for the league. The reason why he didn't want the job, and I have it on good authority, wink, wink, that there were people who wanted him to take that position. The reason he didn't is there's probably twofold. One, he probably knew that he was soon to be a member of the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors, which he was, and that it just becomes really thorny if you're going to be on the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors, own an NWSL team, and then be chairman of the NESL. And there's so many things that you're going to have to conflict yourself out of when those things intersect that it just becomes untenable to try to be the chairman of the board of the league. So I think it just, you know, efficiency and everything else just meant it wasn't going to happen. Frankly, I don't think Malik would say this, but he probably saw that position was cursed based on the last couple of people who had held it, which would be Aaron Davidson and Mark Frisch. So who wants that job? As far as Malik's other role, I mean, again, that's become sort of a subplot to this whole saga, and I'm not going to try to unpack it, and I'm certainly not going to try to carry water for Steve Malik. But you know, Rocco Commisso gets credited for saving the NASL, and he's right, he did. If he hadn't bought the Cosmos and kept them afloat, the Cosmos would have failed, and maybe the league would have too. But that wasn't until, you know, January or so. There were months and months that this sanctioning thing went back and forth last year. And part of the reason why the NASL remained on life support for months was in large part some of the new owners in the league, like Brian Helmick and some of the others, and frankly, Steve Malik, who basically had an inroad with U.S. soccer because, as we now know, at the same time the sanctioning soccer was going on, he was in discussions with the powers that be in the NWSL and U.S. soccer to purchase the Western New York Flash. So he had a rapport with Sunil Gulati and some of the other folks involved with U.S. soccer. Steve Malik was, and I've said this on this program before, and I'll repeat it again, he was one of the ones that was instrumental in getting Traffic Sports investment shares bought out, something that had been a thorn in the side of the league for forever. And the poison between the two sides was so bad that they weren't even talking about that issue, and it kept getting brought up. And Malik was one of the ones that said, well, let me take a crack at this, because he was the one who had last had communications with Traffic Sports within the NASL when he bought the Railhawks from Traffic. So he had been in negotiations with the organization up through October of 2015. So, you know, it's sort of what I push back on is this notion that, you know, Steve Malik has been a problem for the NASL. You know, unless somebody's going to supply specifics, which is the only thing I've asked, you know, I don't really want to hear it because there's a whole lot of specifics that sort of belie that accusation. And to be quite honest, although I give Rocco Commisso credit for what he has done, unless he's got something concrete other than braying at the moon about this, then I really don't want to hear it.
Now, let me just say this. In defense of Peter Schwartz, and he's a good guy, obviously, you know, he's a little bit emotional, of course, but still Peter Schwartz, very good guy, works over at CBS Sports Network and WFAN at times. So I know Peter well. So let me just defend him a little bit here to say, you know, obviously good guy, and he just wants to see, of course, see what's going to happen here with the NASL and hope they can survive.
And
so we'll see what happens there.
Let me interject. I'm not attacking Peter at all. I thought He's done a great job sort of keeping the information out there from his sources. And we had a very amiable back and forth on this particular issue. It's fine. It's not a problem. But this isn't about him. This was about sort of this overall subplot that sort of emerged. And by the way, let me just add this on the Malik subplot, as I'll call it. There's a practical purpose behind this. It's not just hurt feelings. You know, keep in mind that one of the talking points by U.S. Soccer in this whole thing is that this process of implementing pro league standards and sanctioning is fair in part because, hey, we got an NESL owner on the board. Well, from a legal point of view, NESL probably feels like they have to qualify that somehow or come up with a reason why that's not a benefit. I mean, they're being – U.S. Soccer is using that fact to sort of beat NESL over the head in a very small way. So from a legal point of view, they probably feel like they have to push back on that and say, well, yeah, the guy that's on there is not really a help. So, you know, knowing the law like I do, there's probably a practical legal reason why they've taken that position as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And, you know, I try not to pretend I know the law. That's why I always try to bring in the best experts, Neil, and you're one of them. But I think the fun thing is this, Kartik, is that no matter who loves the game so much, depending on what nation you live in, if you know someone who's a lawyer and that loves the game as well, you like to surround yourself with a couple of them and make sure that you have the law or those that know the law, they cover your back very well. So that's why I try to bring in as many experts as I can. Of course, Neil is in mediation. And for those of you not aware, I mean, well, Kartik or Napoon, obviously, but for some of my listeners, Mario Cisfantos, a former assistant DA of the borough of Queens in New York, a big guy that knows, of course, when the whole FIFA scandal happened, that came on and helped me out with some of this situation going on. But let's not get sidetracked here. Once again, this is the 40 Teams Fire American Soccer Show as we talk about this whole sticky situation involving the North American Soccer League's lawsuit on U.S. Soccer trying to keep the Division II status, as there is now new evidence. Of course, we already talked about it, that maybe there was a wrong wording from the judge in Brooklyn, in Judge Brody, Margot Brody, who did not rule in favor of the NESL, and maybe it'll be sent back to court. Of course, Neil Morris, WRALSportsFan.com, Kartik Krishnar, World Soccer Talk, and, of course, Dr. Nipun Chopra from Sock Takes. Kartik, I'll admit, you've probably seen a lot more screwy situations going on than I have. I mean, of course, this one for me takes the cake, but what have you seen, you know, ever since that fateful day that those former USL First Division sides broke away from the USL to create their own league, of course, then becoming the North American Soccer League. What have you seen, you know, from that point where we're seeing so many silly situations that probably could have been prevented?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been, I don't want to relitigate everything, but there's been a succession of bad decisions by NASL owners, you know, misplaced trust in things, perhaps naivety, perhaps an inability to see the forest from the trees, and the bottom line is that there were misplaced ambitions to be a D1 rival league to MLS, and while that's a perfectly reasonable goal down the road, you don't go from being a struggling Division II league to being a Division I league that can compete with Major League Soccer overnight. And I think, for me, the biggest takeaway about everything has been the lack of patience and perspective a lot of NASL owners. And it's their money, and they're investing their money. But they're not investing anywhere near the amount of money MLS owners do. So let's keep that in mind. But the lack of perspective and lack of patience a lot of owners who have invested in the North American Soccer League have had, one, believing that they were somehow entitled to a status that they hadn't actually earned and they hadn't been around the block long enough to get to that point. And two, maybe a lack of understanding in what kind of work was involved in building the infrastructure necessary to be a sustainable even Division II league, to where if you do that and you have the patience and you have perspective and you understand the playing field of American soccer, you build very slowly, very methodically, you have long-term plans, you have long-term thoughts, and then you get to a point in 2013, 2014. By the time you get to 2017 or 2018, you're in a position where, look, we have had a stable league with successful clubs, getting more clubs every year, year by year. We're in some pretty nice markets. Hey, we're entitled, and we've spent a lot of money on soccer infrastructure. We're entitled to be in the conversation with Major League Soccer. And we do things a little differently than Major League Soccer, more to global norms than MLS stuff. I think a lot of people would be on the NASL side if that had been the case. Instead, what you had were various, I don't want to call them schemes, but I'm looking for the right term, various things that the NASL did and NASL clubs did to garner attention, to say, hey, look at us, we matter, we're important. And part of it was out of insecurity, and part of it was out of the reality that a lot of people in the soccer media in the United States are hostile to the New York Cosmos and hostile to NASL by extension, because they have some sort of hostility to the Cosmos, perhaps because of what they're being told by people in U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer about the Cosmos and the Cosmos ambition. But that then manifested itself in a way that the NASL would do all kinds of zany, irrational things to get attention, to get press clips, to appear to look more developed and on more solid footing than they really were. And because they did those things, it became, I think to a large extent, Major League Soccer didn't care about NASL and didn't see them as a threat. But once you start screaming from the mountaintop how great you are, or from actually the top of the hill, you know, MLS is at the top of a mountain, the guy at the top of the mountain is eventually going to want to get rid of you. So those are the things that NASL has done wrong to put themselves in this position. I mean, we could go through all of the things that Bill Peterson said and Seamus O'Brien said and NASL owners said, but there's no point in doing that. It's just been a consistent, I would say, the number one takeaway for me is that they didn't have the patience or the perspective. If they had the patience and they had owners, maybe their owners aren't long-term players. Maybe they weren't the right people to own professional soccer teams. They didn't want to invest over the course of 5 to 7 years to build to get to a certain point. Maybe they wanted it right away. But had they had the patience and perspective, they could have had a 5 to 7 year plan to get themselves to a position where they could have applied for Division I status, and they would have won a lot of friends in the process, because there are a lot of people who are skeptical about what Major League Soccer is doing. And they also would have not made the mistakes they had made, because they would have understood the playing field a little better than they did. I mean, I'll finish on this. With the exception of Tom Papp at FC Edmonton, and that's a Canadian club, so we can take that out of the equation. Every single NASL owner of a U.S.-based club has been only an owner of a playing club since 2014 or more recently than that. In the current case of Ursel, of Nipun's owner in Indy, he's been nibbling around the edges of U.S. soccer since 2010, so maybe we'll exclude him. But everybody else is new. Actually, everybody else is new since, if I'm thinking offhand, since 2015. So they don't have the perspective and long-term understanding and grasp of the U.S. soccer landscape. And to the point that Neil has just you guys have just talked about Steve Malik. Steve Malik is one guy who came into the U.S. soccer system in 2015 and decided he would try and grasp the importance of a youth system, the importance of the women's game, the importance of the pro league standards, and develop relationships within U.S. soccer that would benefit his club and his region, the Triangle region, the Raleigh-Durham area, in North Carolina. That is what the other NASL owners who've come into the league in the last few years should be emulating. They should be emulating Steve Malik. But instead, there's been just a lot of hot air and a lot of bluster. And while I think from an ideological standpoint, NASL is right in most of their critiques about Major League Soccer and right in almost all of their critiques about U.S. soccer. I tend to have more sympathy for MLS than I do for the USSF. I just come back to this point that they haven't put in the time, they haven't put in the resources, and they don't have the understanding yet of what they're actually involved in to be making, to be entitled to the sort of relief, or well, I don't even want to talk about relief from the court system, but the sort of benefits they feel they've earned for some reason from this soccer system.
Clark, one quick question for you, and I just thought about it. If David Downs did not leave the NASL as commissioner, if he decided to remain a commissioner as commissioner and maybe, you know, try to get a better grasp of the situation before all these situations just came out of nowhere, do you think it'd be a different NASL than what we've seen so far?
I'm probably not the right person to ask because I'm pretty biased on this. I mean, I've worked for David Downs. He hired
Well,
me.
Listen, don't
you? I firmly believe if David Downs is state commissioner of the NASL, we would not be having any of these conversations we've had the last few years about this league. I think the league would be in much better shape. I can just say that. With a certain degree of bias, maybe, but also a real conviction that I believe it would have been very different if he had stayed on as commissioner.
Yeah, I mean, look, not to put you in the position, obviously, because he did hire you as his, you are the former communications officer of the North American Soccer League, so that's why I figured, this is probably a guy that, had a solid first two seasons with the NASL being brought back, and I would like to think that, if he wasn't leaving, that if he did stay, that maybe none of the shenanigans would be happening, but pardon me. That's just my personal opinion, of course. But you never know.
Just to real quickly point out, I think Downs' approach. Commissioner Downs had some of the same critiques of Major League Soccer that we have and of the system in this country, and is very versed in the global game. I think the way he would have worked the process is similar to the way Steve Malik is working the process, which is why I had a lot of hope when it appeared like Steve Malik, at the beginning of 2017, was the voice of the NASL and was quoted in their press release, and it seemed like he was dictating the direction of the league. I mean, obviously, different figure from a different background than David Downs. David Downs comes from a broadcasting background, has been versed in world football for years. Steve Malik is new to the sport, but the temperament and the relationship building was very similar. And I thought, okay, we're going to get back on track with this league now that Malik seems to be the preeminent figure. But as Neil described a few minutes ago, and maybe you can chime in again on this, it didn't happen that way. Malik didn't become the preeminent figure. It became Rocco Commisso, and we're having this conversation now, this show right now, talking about these issues, I think, once again, because of that tenor from the NASL, which now most recently has been represented by Rocco Commisso, but you've had people like Bill Peterson in the past taking a similar stand in terms of some of the things they've said publicly.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Nipun, I had a question. Oh, now I just lost it. No, okay. Well, let me ask you this then, Nipun. If talking about what's been going on here with, like you've said before, the Brickyard Battalion has said they want to go to USL. And we don't know what's going to happen, obviously, with this whole situation, because Commisso has basically plenty of money to burn. He says he will continue the lawsuit. He will continue to spend the money that he will try to keep his Cosmos in operation as well as the NASL in operation. But, what happens if that day does come that Commisso doesn't have the money anymore to keep this lawsuit going? What would happen next?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's this assumption from everyone in the NASL, and I've fallen prey to this myself, of assuming that Commisso, because of his $4.5 billion evaluation, is a bottomless pit. Look, he came into this league and this team at a time where the league needed him, and for whatever reason, he decided it was a decent business venture. I don't believe that Mr. Rocco Commisso is a stupid businessman. And at some point, he is going to look at his bottom line and say, look, dropping $20 million a year is just pointless, especially when you believe the reports that we all know about, which suggest that he's one of the two or three owners who are going to help float the six possible teams next year if we ever get to that stage. So at some point, he's going to say, losing all this million is all this money is pointless. I have money towards I'm spending $13 million a year on Cosmos. I'm spending $4 or $5 million a year on these two teams I'm supporting. I'm spending X hundreds of thousands a year on supporting lawyers for this litigation. Maybe if I just walk away from this, I'm going to go back to losing $0 a year as opposed to $20 million a year. And I think that day probably isn't too far away. I mean, it's just an assumption on all our parts that Mr. Camisa is in this for the long run, and that he is so heavily invested in soccer and in the NASL that he would stay in this race until he saw it through its very end, whether that means NASL dissolving, whether that means keeping the litigation going for years. I just don't think that that's reasonable. I don't think that we can expect that from someone who obviously has a good business record. And kind of putting a bow on this thing, ultimately we have to it will be Rocco Camisa's decision in terms of how long he goes, but whether or not he is invested in this project long term, it has to be on the NASL and NASL's teams to ensure that it truly is independent. And what I mean by that is when you're talking about these other teams that are probably, if NASL survives, we're talking about these other teams that are going to be heavily reliant on Mr. Rocco Camisa, Mr. Ricardo Silva, and Mr. Robert Palmer's money. They have to make sure that they are self-sufficient by the end of year one. Because if they fall into the trap of believing that, hey, these three gentlemen are going to support my team for 3 years so I can figure out sponsorships, et cetera, much, much later, I think that is setting themselves up for failure. So if the NASL survives and these six NPSL teams do become NASL teams, they need to make sure that they make the most of this opportunity and not just collect the paycheck and not make responsible business decisions.
Can I say something there for a minute?
Go ahead,
Daniel,
Brian.
Because I think this is important. Anxious to get everyone's perspective on this. Look, there are a lot of newer fans of NASL who don't realize how many owners in the past have appeared as committed as Rocco Camisa, have thrown money around, and have then, once the losses got too great, just bailed and bailed quickly. Neil has written the definitive story, the saga of one of those families, the Wellman family in North Carolina with the Carolina Railhawks, who were one of the great forces, driving forces behind creating NASL, and bailed out and left a trail of deceit and trouble for the league before the league even kicked the ball. And we've had guys like Mark Frisch, who is the immediate predecessor to Rocco Camisa, is the chair of the Board of Governors, who had grandiose ideas and had a club launch that was as strong as any in NASL history. I was at their first game when they played FC Edmonton, and they were, I don't know what the official attendance was, 15,000 people there just 2 years ago. And by the end of the second season, he had lost so much money, even though he had had all these grandiose ideas, had spent so much money, had become the chair of the Board of Governors, that he bailed. The most recent example is the gentleman, the group out in San Francisco that Napoon knows more about, that talked big, had grandiose ideas, spent a ton of money on the outset, and at the end of year one looks like they're folding the team. So for NASL fans who, and there are many of them who DM'd me and contacted me the last few days saying, oh, Rocco's going to fight this till the end. They're going to go. It's going to be years and years and years, and he's in it to win it type of thing. Listen to what Napoon said. I think that is very, very astute analysis. And I would also remind people that as much as Rocco Camisa has done, he's done some great things in the last 9 months, 10 months of owning a professional soccer team. A year ago, when Jurgen Klinsmann was sacked as the manager of the U.S. national team, and people were calling for Sunil Gulati to resign as the U.S. soccer president. Rocco Camisa wasn't even involved in the game of professional soccer or the U.S. soccer conversation. So he's made himself very relevant very quickly, and props to him for that, and congratulations to him for that. But we've seen people who've done that disappear just as quickly. And I think it's important that listeners understand that.
Yep, because, you know, money makes the world go around, that's for sure. But let me throw this out there, Neil. Let's just say hypothetically, the NASL does dissolve. It's no more. And or that they decide to give up being Division II and they go to D3. Does this mean, like, the NASL will be D3, or does this mean that Peter Wilt's NISA takes over?
No. That's the answer. That's the answer to the. There's a fundamental truth behind the framing of your question, which is really where we are now, which is the NASL teams, and I've sort of rolled this around in my head, and I'd love to hear what Napoon thinks about this. They are facing as I wrote in the article that's coming out tomorrow, they're facing an encroaching state of purgatory. Their options are becoming more limited by the week. And if teams decide to stick around for the appeal of this preliminary injunction, which will not be heard by a 3-judge panel until as early as December, the week of December 11th, perhaps with not a decision until after the first of the year, potentially. Are these teams going to stick around? Can they stick around? What are their options if they don't stick around? Because, you know, there's a lot of tough decisions that have to be made. Maybe some of these teams already know what they're going to do. I mean, I suspect NCFC, North Carolina FC, knows what they're going to do. But what is Edmonton going to do? What is Miami going to do? And here's why this matters. What are the options? This goes back to the sort of the core of your questions. And again, I sort of lay this out in my article tomorrow. The NASL has not applied to be D3, and they've shown absolutely no indication that they're going to, and they're certainly not going to do so before the hearing of this appeal. And I don't know when it becomes too late to do so, when U.S. Soccer can just turn around and say, oops, you ran out of time, which, given the fact that they take an antagonistic position towards the Federation, they could easily say. So that's number one. Teams may want to join USL, but if they wait too long, when does that window close? Now, we knew last year during the sanctioning saga that the door remained ajar for several teams into December and January, but that was because all the parties were kept at the table by U.S. Soccer. They may not have been in agreement, and USL was playing hardball, but they were all kept at the table by Sunil Gulati personally and by U.S. Soccer because they were trying to work this thing through. Well, sanctioning was decided relatively early this year, and now there's been a lawsuit filed, so U.S. Soccer has no inclination to keep the door open for teams to move to USL as they might have last year and maybe even a month or two ago. So, you know, USL is not going to want to do like they did last year and wait forever to put their format and their schedule out, which they waited much longer last year than they wanted to. So when does that window close? NISA, that's the popular sort of choice for a lot of folks. Let's join with NISA and apply as D2 or D3. Well, again, D3 is an option that a lot of NESL current members have shown that they don't want to explore. And we don't know whether NISA has teams that are ready to go for D3, much less D2. They haven't applied for sanctioning yet. We don't know what the status of that is. And, oh, by the way, as I've repeated on many occasions, we don't know whether the governing structure of NISA – first off, we don't know exactly what it is. And number two, we don't know whether it would appeal to some of these NASL owners who are used to sort of ruling the roost. And being able to collect entry and exit fees. So we don't even know if that those two entities would be compatible. So those are the options. They all come with fundamental issues. They all come with time constraints. And the only other option after that is teams not playing next year and maybe en masse. And that's kind of the apocalyptic scenario that we have to start discussing and we have to start thinking about because, you know, you can be like Thelma and Louise and decide to run off the side of the cliff, but we know what happens at the bottom of the valley. There are decisions that have to be made. There's not going to be lifelines like there were last year because of the posture that NESL has taken. You know, fans and everyone around this league who are all about the fight, which is fine. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm all for standing up for your legal rights. But what we haven't really entertained is the notion that the expectations of some of these owners, the posture that the league has taken, and the calendar is squeezing in to the point of where some of these teams are going to have to take a long look or risk not playing next year. And I'm curious to see what Napoon thinks about sort of that scenario.
Go ahead, Napoon.
Karthik and I actually had a long conversation about this yesterday, so this is a deja vu in some ways.
Ooh.
I think I don't see a scenario where the league is going to go dark or not play next year. Well, let me rephrase. I don't see a scenario where most of these teams would favor a situation like that over falling to D3, which was kind of the point I was making earlier. Neil, you were absolutely right. I should have phrased my point better. My point earlier meant to be the league cannot. There's no way the league can be D3. I was more specifically talking about the owners. I think the owners, in spite of their rhetoric, would rather be D3 than not play next year. The reason I say that is I've talked to people involved in these teams, and yes, outwardly, the concept of them losing D2 status and therefore going under, that was important legally. But there are some owners here who invested a lot of money and to have to back out after 1 year would be detrimental when they could play in a D3 league and maybe try to sell the team in the future where they could recoup some of the money. So I don't see a situation, at least in my opinion, where these teams would not, or at least some of these teams would not be amenable to joining a Division III league, which then brings up the point, what in the world is a Division III league going to be? Neil, you're absolutely right. NESA has not applied for D3 status. They're not going to be D3 before this stuff goes down with the appeal. So it is all up in the air. And I think what we should be talking about is the fact that everything is an option. And through that lens, and this is what Karthik and I talked about for 45 minutes yesterday, is through, at least this is my opinion, through that lens, I think NESA is in a stronger position now than they were a month ago. I think a month ago, NESA was dead in the water. If you had told me a month ago NESA was going to play in 2018, I would have said no way. But I think NESA will, but I think now, given that the NASL is likely going to be dead, and using my argument, I believe at least some of these teams would be open to an independent league that could reapply for 2019. I think NESA will play next year in a Division III format, and it will probably include some current NASL team. Not all of them. I think teams like Indy 11 will probably join, possibly join USL. I think Puerto Rico FC will not be able to make the jump. I think Deltas are done. Cosmos, maybe. I think Miami is possibly an option. I think Jacksonville absolutely would be an option for NESA. So, you know, in my opinion, at least a couple of these clubs will make the jump to NESA. You bring on six or seven of the other teams that signed LOIs, and you're up to that magical number eight. And we have to remember that a brand new league has a much lower threshold for, at least this is my understanding, maybe I'm misstating this, but a brand new league is, has a much lower threshold in USSF's eyes in terms of requirements. And that's why, because of all these reasons, and this is all conjecture and we can break down each one of these arguments, but my belief at this moment on November 8th is that I believe it's more likely that NISA will play next year than NASL will play next year.
So, Kartik, let me throw this at you right now, because what we're saying right now about what the possibilities could be with the NASL and maybe what NISA can be, which has a stronger possibility, that lawsuit or the motion that Ricardo Silva, along with Dennis Crowley from the Kingston Stockade of the NPSL, going to the Court of Arbitration for Sport about the pro-rel situation, could that be next? Because, you know, NASL, we don't know what's going to happen, but are they on the way out with this whole legal situation? And at the same time, if NISA comes in, I mean, do they pull that back? They take that off the table?
No, I don't. I think that's independent of leagues, right? It's an entity, Miami FC, who, if NASL ceases to exist and they're out of business, they can continue. My assumption is that it's a legal entity. They'll continue, and they filed this claim, and Ricardo Silva is committed to that. And the Kingston Stockade aren't going anywhere. So I think that claim will continue, and that conversation will continue, and that's a conversation that has advanced even since the Deloitte report and since the CAS claim was filed because of the U.S.'s elimination from World Cup qualifying. And the discussion now of how our pro leagues are structured and how promotion and relegation potentially could fit into that and player development, et cetera, it's an independent issue from the NASL and the NASL's legal situation. And in fact, it is a situation. It is a past claim. I should add that NASL, when given the chance to comment by me when it was filed, indicated to me that the league had no opinion one way or another on it. It is a completely independent action by Miami FC and their owner, Ricardo Silva.
We'll see what happens there. But gentlemen, as always, I enjoy this discussion very much, and I thank all of you for being a part of this because, you know, these are real discussions going on below Major League Soccer that we need to have. I mean, pardon me, this is the crux of the situation we're having here, and while I think it's admirable, you know, what Rocco Commissio is doing, trying to find a way to keep the NASL afloat, maybe this is a losing proposition, and maybe it is time for Peter Wilt's NISA or NISA to come in and be a D3 side. But, you know, once again, there's a lot of questions I think they're still not answered yet, even though I think we've answered most of them. I think there's still a certain amount that hasn't been answered yet. And it looks like it's going to be played out in the courts here in the United States. So all I can say is that if there is going to be a way for this whole thing to be in the favor of the NASL, you know, something's got to come up quick, because if not, it's either go to D3, which means they're going to have to swallow their pride, or just go down swinging, and, you know, we're going to lose more clubs than maybe bitten off more than the NASL can chew. I think that's what the situation is. But listen, I want to thank all of you for joining me once again. I appreciate it, and hope to have you on again soon before the new year comes in 2018. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, Napoon. And thank you, Kartik.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, guys.
All right. And thank you to all of you that have called in and or at least listened in. And thank you, of course, to Roger from South Florida who's called in to ask a question and normally don't really let everyone call in during these types of shows, but that's okay. But still, though, I have to say that there's still more questions that need to be answered, and I really, really hope that we get those questions answered, and we'll see when we get to them or we get to a real conclusion to the situation. But I want to thank Kartik Krishnayer from World Soccer Talk, Dr. Nipun Chopra, from Sock Takes over in Indianapolis, Indiana. And as always, Neil Morris, WRALsportsfan.com, also a mediation lawyer that at least we can get some legal aspects of the situation. My name's Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you again for listening. Join me this coming Monday night as we talk to Mr. Dennis Crowley, the owner of the Kingston Stockade of the NPSL in the Pro-Rel Court of Arbitration for Sport lawsuit against U.S. Soccer. Have a good night, and as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Take care and talk to you next time. Bye-bye for now.